The audition scene in Walk the Line is one of my favorite scenes ever because I think it's so emblematic of what you see in our churches, in that there is this lost soul faking, trying to be something that he's not, and using God and cheesy Christianity as an excuse to hide. And the call by him to put his soul out there and have to really express who he is and what he thinks and what he feels, and even the effect that that has on two other guys. And I love the part where he goes, "Johnny, whatever you getting ready to do, we ain't heard that before." I mean, I love, there ain't nothing about that I don't love. I love all that. And so I think there's something important there for us, and I'll keep mining that, and we'll keep showing it. Grab your notes. We're going to look at a list. We've been talking for 8 weeks. We got one more week together. Don't want you to miss it. As we bring together a few more practical nuggets this week, week 8 and week 9 are given to being able to bring more practical energy in, more practical ideas. But we don't want to start with practical ideas because they have to be based and rooted in theology. A theology of what masculinity is and a philosophy of how we want to live, and it all has to be tied down to those ideas, which is why we started in Genesis 3 and we looked at Adam and his passivity. We looked at Eve and her autonomy, her self-law, self-rule, moving outside of what God had for her, and to see him just step back and let things unfold. And we're seeing that passivity over and over and over in ourselves. We talked about wounds, and by wound we mean a deficit, something that's missing, something that we've got to look at, we got to deal with, or else it will continue to linger. The effects will continue to linger. So we got to deal with some wounds. The most profound of those wounds is what we call the depravity wound, that we are broken and that we are sinful, that we cannot get to God on our own. We cannot make ourselves right. It is through the life and the death and the resurrection and the indwelling spirit, indwelling of the Holy Spirit, that we are made right with God and that we have life in him. And we talked about what a redeemed masculinity can look like, even theoretically, the second Adam, that he comes to give us life. We've talked about a definition of rejecting passivity, accepting responsibility, leading courageously, and expecting God's reward. Big ideas that become a grid and a filter for how we think about life, for how we make decisions. And now, I'm going to give you a list. A list that is designed to not be comprehensive by any stretch of the imagination. It's more symbolic than anything else. It's catalytic in the sense that it should put some ideas in your head and create some movement. It should cause something in you to spark and go, well, it's not this, but it might be that. But I wouldn't get to that if I didn't at least talk about this and think about this. And that's what a list is for. It's to be catalytic. It's to create some movement. Let me give you the negative on what a list is all about. The negative for a list of do's and don'ts is that it makes you a Muslim. All right? It makes you Jewish. A law keeper. It basically appeals to the most fundamental parts of your soul that say, I can function independently of God. I can do whatever I want, and I can get there on my own. And so I will keep this rule, I will keep this law, and God will be happy with me. And if God's not happy, at least I'll be happy with me. So I will be self-sufficient, self-providing. I will express my independence, and that I will identify some rules, and I'll keep some rules, and I'll be happy with me, and other people will be happy with me, and God will be happy with me. Let me just tell you, you can keep all the rules in the world, and at the end of time, you will not be happy with yourself. Your wife will not be happy with you. Your children will not be happy with you, and ultimately, God will not be happy with you. So let's be clear. This is the negative of list. It creates a religious culture. It appeals to the religious soul that is embedded deep in all of us. And so I don't know how many times I sat in a counseling session and heard a man say, look, I've done this and this and this and this. And she's like, hey, thanks for your resume. I never asked for any of that. That's not really what I was asking for. All right? So that's the negative on the list. Here's the positive on the list. The positive of a list is that part of how we learn by doing. Okay, there you can philosophize and stay in an ivory tower and talk theory all day. Higher education, that's fine. But that has some great strengths to it, in that you get to ponder what the great ideas are, but you may never get to carry them out. The other extreme is that you can just be out executing like a minion without any real thinking of what you can be doing it right, but you might be doing the wrong thing, which is just executing. We're out executing, making things happen, but we're not even executing on the right thing. You see this all the time. So we can talk too much and we can do too much. But a good list that's catalytic for us puts us in a position to begin to have some experiences and to learn by doing. Moses will learn more about God by following him and obeying him. Who shall I say sent me? You tell them I am that I am has sent me. He doesn't ever really get clear about that issue unless he's in the middle of having to follow and obey God. So I'm making the case all day long. Are there some negatives to a list? Yes, but there's some very great positives to a list also. Let's crank through them. We've got a long way to go, a lot to get done. I'm going to go real fast, talk real fast. It's a great thing about internet. You can go back and listen to it later. You're supposed to be able to listen about 5 times faster than I can speak. Let's find out. Number one, a man is committed to living a redeemed masculinity. Number one, he does this. He includes his wife in envisioning. E-N, envisioning the future. To be able to sit down with your wife and say, what do we want? What do we want to be? What do we want to do? Same thing for a single man. What do I want to be? What do I want to do? What is it? What I want life to be like in the future? If you're a single guy, you're going to gather some friends. You're going to kick around this idea. You're going to set some big goals. And then you're going to backtrack to it and go, well, if that's where I want to be here, then I got to do this, got to do this, got to do this, got this. So this is where I am. So now I got to start back and got to work that way towards it. Let me tell you about women. Women want to be a part of something. The name Azer, a helper suitable, means one who comes alongside, who brings life and strength and power to something. And I've had so many women tell me in the halftime of life with their husband, when he's making this transition, after about 6 months, I'll say, how are you doing with your husband's transition? She's like, I'm good with the transition. She goes, I just like to know what it is. I'm like, what does that mean? She goes, I don't care what we do, just as long as we go do something. And I'm like, surely you care. She's like, I'll be honest with you. We got 5 things to choose from. Makes no difference to me. I just want to be a part of something. Women want to latch on to something, be a part of something, and be caught up in something. My wife's biggest frustration with me right now is that we started out to plan a church together, and now we are pulled apart. Because I got to go work all day, and she's got to do her stuff all day, and we're not really together like we were 15 years ago. Because then she felt like she was caught up in something, much more than she does now. Number two, this man living redeemed masculinity, he accepts spiritual responsibility for his family. We're going to accept all responsibility, but particularly spiritual responsibility. It's not my wife's job to wake everybody up for church. It's not your job to go sit in the car and wait for her to get all the kids out to the car so y'all can go to church. Not her job to wake everybody up. Not her job to read and pray with the kids. Not her job to talk with your children. Not her job to get the family to serve somewhere. Not her job to model sacrifice. Not her job to come to church and sing. So everybody goes, the kids go, oh, mom likes to sing in church. Oh, no, dad likes to sing in church. Dad's terrible, but he likes to sing in church. All right, that's the way it is in my family. They're like, dad is a little lower, dad, a little lower. But at least they're seeing my lips move. All right? Because when God comes and the family is a wreck, and when he comes looking, he's looking for you. He's not looking for her. Why weren't we at church? Why weren't we involved in serving? Why weren't we giving? Why weren't we involved in something? Why didn't our children learn how to give their lives away? God's not coming looking for her. He's coming looking for you. Why is there unresolved conflict in your home? People can't get along? Because you're not bringing resolution to it. Number three, he prays with and for, I'll add, he prays with and for his wife on a regular basis. It's very challenging for most men. We feel very inadequate, very pulled apart, but it's a very healthy, very intimate thing. In our home, we have chronic illness. So our home cannot run off of human power alone. You have got to have supernatural energy to accomplish what our family accomplishes. And so even just this week, I shared something with my wife of some new challenges that we're facing, and I gave her a symbol and just said, here's a renewed commitment that I have to pray for you in this really difficult situation that you face with a couple of our children. because I know this is hard, and I can't quit my job and come home and do it with you all day. I can't do that. I'm glad I can't do that, actually. I mean, I was like, oh God, I'm going to pray. I'm going to pray for you, right? The least I can do. It acknowledges our dependence on God, that I cannot solve everything, I cannot do everything. Number four, redeemed masculinity is willing to say that I am sorry and forgive me to his family. This man will say, I'm sorry and forgive me to his family. Let me just tell you, sometimes a man will think, being right is really important to leading your family. Let me tell you, that is an intuitive thought, isn't it? If you're going to lead, got to be right. Can I tell you something? Exactly the opposite is true. You want to lead, got to be wrong. Got to be wrong, and got to be the first one to know that you're wrong, and got to be the first one to talk about you're wrong. And then when they come to you and say, hey, you're wrong, say, you're right. You're right that I'm wrong, and tell you what, I'm more wrong than you know. I've covered up most of how wrong I am from you. You think I'm a little bit wrong? I'm way more wrong than you know. Here's how wrong I am. I thought this and this. I didn't tell you that part. That was wrong too. And this part's wrong, and then I was going to do this. That would be even more wrong. What people want is not someone who's perfect, because we all know that we're not working with perfect people. What we want is not someone who is perfect, but someone who's perfectible. Someone that you can speak into, because it goes to the issue of trust. Is that if this person can say that they're wrong, then they have a higher cause than themselves. And that higher cause could be something greater than just who they are and what they want. And I can trust them. If their highest cause is themselves, I can't trust them. So being able to say that we're wrong is really important. It's critical to being able to lead. And it articulates in a tangible way the kind of humility that makes life work. And now no one has anything to protect. We can all be that humble. We can all kind of self-efface and go, okay, this is where we are. Number five, he discusses household responsibilities with his wife and makes sure they are fairly distributed. Especially if you have a wife who is working outside the home. Because what she'll do is go work all day and then come home and work all night. And so you'll work all day, she'll work all day. You'll come home and relax, she'll work all night. So, but even if it's not, even when you have, well, we have five children, there's a lot to be done. So we have to, every 6 months, we have to evaluate. We use New Year and summer to kind of evaluate how are we doing as a family, how are the chores going, make sure, because you know this child was doing these chores, we got to take those chores and give them to this child because this one's getting older. You got to move on to something new. We got to get you a bigger challenge. You take that off of your mom, and then we just kind of hand the chores down. But with a wife, to be able to say that things are fairly distributed, what is wearing you out? What is overwhelming to you? What are you having a hard time with? How can I help? There are some things. When I ask that question, my wife will bring up, usually one, she'll bring up a handful of things, and one of them, I'll just look at her and go, why are we doing that? She goes, because I thought, da-da-da-da-da. I'm like, no, I don't need to do that. I tell you what, let's just quit. We'll quit on that. We ain't doing that. That's crazy. We're not doing that. And then another one, she'll say, and then there's this big thing. I was like, hold on. I'll make a phone call. Hey, and I'll just, someone that I know wants to handle that, I'll just give it to them. And I'll just solve her problem just like that. Now, the other three, not so easy. But there'll always be one thing that we shouldn't be doing and one thing that's so easy to fix. Usually one phone call can do it. And so maybe she's doing too much and you got to figure that out. And she may be doing something that doesn't need to happen at all. The biggest conflict, this is the craziest thing. One of the biggest conflicts we had a handful of years ago was over the dishwasher. I said, babe, we got five kids. There ain't no future in you doing dishes. These other kids are getting older. You gotta turn it over to them. She's like, they don't load the dishwasher right. I said, I'm sorry, what? She goes, they don't load it right. I'm like, is there a protocol? Is there a manual or something about how that's supposed to be done? She goes, well, they're just not, it's not efficient. They're not getting as many dishes in as they could on each load. I was like, and how does that affect us negatively? She's like, well, they might have to run an extra load. Which, does that cost a lot? Is there a piece here I'm missing? We fought for 6 months over that dishwasher. Until finally, she is so exhausted trying to do it all. She looked at me, she goes, I ain't doing this anymore. I was like, huh? Wish I had thought of that. I was like, all right, get in here. We're going to learn how to put these. She's going to tell you one more time how to get these dishes in here correctly. All right? And when she bought into that idea, she was like a woman set free. And she's trying to give everything away. I was like, oh, come on, hold on. But that takes leadership. Someone's got to let her off the hook. And here's what I would tell you. Some of your wives are succeeding at the wrong things. They're determined to have that house clean every day and straight and neat. Can I tell you something? That isn't a huge value. That isn't that important. People coming over, you need to be straight, that's fine. You want to be straight, that's fine. But a woman stressed out because her house needs to be straight every minute of every day, you're succeeding at the wrong things. You got too many other important things to do. Got lives to change. You got kids to invest in. Let that stuff stay a mess and pour your life into these children. You got way more important things to do than to make sure this room is straight. And if someone comes over and sees a basket of laundry on the couch, that'd be a good thing. Then they think, oh, real people live here. That'd be fine. But only you can get that across, right? Number 6, he goes over the upcoming week with his wife to clarify their schedule and anticipate any pressure points. Let's hope that my wife does not listen to this talk. This is something that we have got to get, we got to be good at. Is that we got to sit down and we got to talk, we got to communicate, we got to lead well, we got to manage well. And here's what I'll tell you, the calendar is a big deal. The calendar is a huge deal. Technology that we have has caused life to increase its pace and its speed. And so the irony of this moment, I'm actually supposed to be in 2 other places right now. I was supposed to go to dinner tonight with the family, and our schedule got messed up, and my son has a basketball game in the next city over. And so I was supposed to be in 3 places tonight. And here's the thing. I'd love to tell you that's just tonight. I do that all the time. And so my wife, it drives her insane. And so we are working on it. We are getting way better, right? And I think you've got to have some time away, not just on a weekly basis to plan. You got to take a couple days a year and go away and sit down and talk and plan, create some vision and make some big decisions. What do we want to do this year? Here's the calendar. Where we want to go? What do we want to accomplish? What do we want our children to see? What kind of vacation do we want? What are some things we want to accomplish in our home? What needs to change? Can be can communicate lots of value to her about how much you value your home and what you think is important. Number 7, he provides financially for his family's basic living expenses. Provides financially for his family's basic living expenses. So a woman has a choice of whether she will work or not, but a man does not. A man, it is his ultimate responsibility to provide, which means if you don't have a job, you have to get a job till you can get a job. Well, I'm going to be unemployed for 2 years because I'm waiting on management or an executive level job. You got to get a job, and then you'll get a better job, but you got to work. And so I would tell seminary students, they'd come in, and you'd meet them, they'd be first-year guys, and I'd say, oh, what are you doing for a job? And they'd be like, well, my wife has a really great job. She's a nurse, and so I'm just going to focus on school. And I'd say, bro, I wouldn't do that if I were you. Get you a job at McDonald's, get you a job landscaping, cleaning pools, something. He's like, we don't really need the money. I was like, it ain't about the money. She needs to see you go out and work harder than she does so that she can respect you. She's like, well, she understands I'm doing my school. I was like, no, school's weak. School ain't that important. School sounds like a big deal when you first get here because you're in grad school and it's big time, grad school, seminary, all that. I was like, uh-uh. School ain't going to mean nothing in 12 months. She's going to be like, school. School's what little kids do. So take less grades. Don't make as good of grades. Work. Be so tired you can't think straight till you just about collapse. And at least she'll look at you and she'll feel like she can respect you. All right, so that's part of our role. Number 8. He keeps his family financially sound and out of harmful debt. There is some debt that we can use. Most debt does not benefit us. Most debt turns into slavery. All right, and we got to be thinking about our future. We got to be thinking about our family. One of the things I've noticed in our congregation is that we have a very generous congregation, but so many times people cannot be generous because they are enslaved to debt. And so they can't take the weekend off and hang out with family. They can't go blow $300 on something with the family, just having a good time for a couple days out of town because they got debt. So we have a big need that comes up in the church. They can't give $1,000 to it because they just are covered up in debt. So I would tell you, if you are in debt, you got to hook up with Dave Ramsey. Do I love everything Dave Ramsey says and does? I do not. But he has been an effective communicator around this issue, and he gives effective tools for people getting out of debt. So I back him. We back him as a church. And I would say, if that's not what you want to do, pick something else. But getting out of debt is a big deal. It's very important. Number 9. He seeks the consultation of his wife on all major financial decisions. We have to over-communicate when we talk about finances. One of the things we have to do before we get in a situation is we need to decide how we decide. How do we decide to spend $100? Can you do that by yourself? Or do we need to talk before we do that? How do we spend $50? Do we need to talk or can you do that? Is there a budget? Is there not a budget? How much are we saving? Can you spend $1,000? Can you buy a car? Do we need to talk about buying a car? How are we going to do it? We need to decide how we decide before we decide, which means we've got to have some conversations about what's coming our way. All right, so we want to over-communicate. I heard Mike Jabero say this years ago. Your friend offers you this great business deal. If you can't come home and explain it to your wife in real simple terms and her go, oh yeah, I get that, I understand that, that makes sense to me. If you can't do that, that's not a good business deal for you. There may be other reasons it's not a good business deal, but that would be the first one. All right? If you can't explain it in simple terms, if you have to look at her and go, well, babe, you really don't understand business. You don't understand this kind of stuff. It's over your head a little bit because you're not out there like I am. So, anyway, I'm just going to go ahead and do it. Let me tell you, we've cleaned up a bunch of those messes. I would not do that. Number 10. He makes sure that he and his wife have drawn up a will and have arranged a well-conceived plan for their children in case of his death or their death. Right? He's drawn up a will. It is my responsibility to take care of my family to the degree that I can underneath God's dominion, whether I'm alive or whether I'm dead. So that means I got to get a will to make sure that everything's kind of handled. They don't have to, people aren't freaking out trying to figure that out after I'm gone, and that you have insurance. All right, so you can find someone, insurance agent, not hard to find. Say, hey, here's my life. Help me with some insurance. Right? Number 11. He follows through with commitments that he's made to his wife. Your word must be gold. You follow through with commitments you've made to your wife. Your word must be gold. The stability of your life to your wife and to your children makes God make sense. When a man does not keep his word, his children forever question whether they can trust God. And I promise you do not want that on you. But a man who keeps his word, when he reads a passage about God's faithfulness, that person goes, yeah, I get that. It's the oddest thing. It's one of the most interesting things to a person. He's a person with stable dad, communicated, loved him. When he reads the scriptures one way, this other dad who's just always breaking his promises, that person reads the scriptures in a totally different viewpoint. Number 12, he demonstrates, same idea, trustworthiness. What you say only makes sense if your life matches it. And here's what I mean. Is that your decisions cannot benefit you. They have to benefit others. The decisions that you make clearly benefit the people around you, not yourself. Because there will come a time when things will be cloudy and a decision's got to be made and there's tension and you do not agree and you have to lean across the table and look at your wife and say, here's the deal. I promise you, I got this. I know what I'm doing. You're going to have to trust me. I know you don't like this, and I know you don't feel this. I know you don't understand it, but have I ever made any decisions that just benefit me? Has this deal for the last 10 years, has it ever been just about me? Is there anything here that you're like, look at what I've been doing to use everybody to benefit me? And then she needs to look at you and go, no, it's always been about us. I say, okay, well then because of that, I'm telling you, you can trust me now. Because there will be a moment when you have clarity about something that she does not, and you cannot get her there, and you still have to make a decision because we have to move. And you're going to have to call on her to trust you. And then the question will be in that moment, can she trust you? Can she release her deal and go, It's a good point. Got an incredible track record. It's difficult, but I'm going to trust him. Your life will dictate that. Number 13, anticipates the stages his marriage will pass through. Every marriage is going to have a bunch or a series of smaller marriages within it. Newly married is one marriage, all right? Been married 10 years, can't have children. That's a different marriage. Married with one small child, that's another marriage. A marriage with three young children, that's a different kind of marriage. A marriage with teenagers, a different kind of marriage. A marriage with grown children, empty nesters, different kind of marriage. All those are different marriages. Different ways of communicating, different expectations about how we spend our time, different kinds of vacations. How we spend our money is very different in each one of those. They all have strengths. They all have weaknesses. When you're looking at three toddlers and you get these little kids, you're like, oh my gosh, this is the most difficult thing ever. What's the value in this? The value in that is, where are your kids? Right there. Right there. Anything going to happen to them tonight? No. Why not? Because they're right there. I'm going to lock them in their room in just a few minutes. We're going to go to bed. Where are they going to be in the morning? Right there. That's where they are. What are we going to do at lunch? I'm going to let them outside in the backyard. It's fenced in backyard. They're going to play. Where are they going to be? Right there. When that's over, where are they going to be? Right there. I mean, that's how it is monotonous and tiring and physically draining. But tomorrow night at this time, you'll say, where are your oldest three? And I'll be like, she's there. He's there. And the third one's there. And I got two that are home. Like, well, it's like 10:30. She's driving home in the rain. I know. I'm praying. I'm trying to trust God for this. It's killing me. It's really hard. All right, there's some great strengths to this. My wife and I can go out there. We're like, hey, y'all handle. When I get back, I want this house cleaned up. I want all the dishes done. I want all this done. Go wash some clothes. Get this. I won't come back to this. It's nice. We're going to get a steak. I'll see you in a little bit. All right, can't do that when they're right there. Someone's got to watch it when they're right there. So there are different stages, and they all have great strengths and weaknesses. And the only way you can find out what the next stage is, you got to find an older man who's been there, and you need an older man to tell you how great the stage that you're in is, and then tell you how great the next stage can be, and where the pitfalls and the weaknesses and the struggles are. It's the great value of older men. It's one of the great values of older men, is they can explain to you who you are and where you are and where you are headed. But your expectations around conversation, around vacations, around sex, all those things are very different in the different stages. They all function very differently. 14. He frequently will tell his wife what he likes about her. He praises his wife often in public. Frequently will tell his wife what he likes about her. He praises his wife often in public. Criticism is not your spiritual gift. It is the destroyer of your marriage. You need to tell your wife how smart she is in the way that she is smart. So it's legitimate and authentic. Tell her how beautiful she is in the way that she is beautiful. Recognize how gifted she is and how talented she is. And you knew these things when you dated her. It's what drew you to her. But now you've let some of the things that aren't her strengths overshadow the great things that drew you to begin with. And it's your job to marshal that. It's your job to leverage that. It's your job to explain that. And so I realized a few years ago that there was a lot of work for me to do in this area. And so now my wife could tell you all the things that I love about her from a beauty standpoint particularly. I buy most of her clothes. And so I know she looks great in a pencil skirt. I dress her most of the time. Now, I don't buy her jeans. She's got enough jeans. Big tension in our relationship. You got plenty of jeans. You don't need more jeans, right? But for her, that communicates that I get her, that I know her, that I love her, that I understand how beautiful she is and the way that she's beautiful. And so that's going to be different for each of us. How your wife receives that, how she understands that. Number 15, encourage his wife to grow as an individual. For her to grow as an individual, provides time for his wife to pursue personal interests. So hard to do with young children. But like in our home, it's guitar lessons. Maybe she has a job on the side. You know, when we first moved here, my wife worked at Gap Kids one Sunday afternoon a week. 4 hours on Sunday afternoon, she worked at Gap Kids. We about went broke doing that. I mean, her check, there was it was half of what she was spending at Gap Kids, right? But there was a great outlet for her. She loved it. Number 16, deals with distractions so he can talk to his wife and family. You got to turn the TV off. You got to deal with the kids. You got to rally everybody together, demand their attention, talk, communicate. Sometimes you got to remove your wife from the children. For us, we have to go to a restaurant to get out of our house because there's so much activity there. And maybe she's too wrapped up in the children. And so you've got to extract her from that. Sometimes I lean my head out the bedroom door. I said, I need no more children to come to this door. The next child that comes to this door and knocks on this door, something bad's going to happen to you. All right, go tell all those other minions the same thing. We just need 5 minutes is all I'm asking for. So you got to pull away. Number 17, works to keep romance in the relationship. Love has to be communicated verbally and in action, even sacrificial action. Works to keep romance in the relationship, whether it's a date night. You can't have a relationship without time. How you get that time? What kind of time that is? That's your deal. How often, how much? Do you like to hike? Do you like to dance? What do you like to do? And it's going to be different for everybody. You got to figure that out. How you communicate that kind of love to her. How you carve out the time. And it's time on her terms. And my wife's not real demanding, but one thing that she loves to do, she loves to shop. She doesn't have to spend money. She just loves to shop, other than the Gap Kids thing. Other than that, loves to shop. So I have to marshal all my energy up. Here we go. We're going to accomplish nothing. I can do this. We're going to walk and we're going to talk and we're going to evaluate, but we're not going to buy it. I mean, I want to kill, right? I was like, let's just get it. And after about 40 minutes, I'm like, the next thing we're buying. I gotta feel like I'm accomplishing something. But something about that communicates love to her. It's another series for another day, but you are the sexual leader of your home. And here's what I'm telling you, most of you are not. For most of us, your wife is the sexual leader of your home. It's what, when, and how she wants on her terms, and you're not really leading in that area. All right, it's another issue for another day, but let's just give a taste of it. We deal with quest for purity later. But you are to channel your sexual energy towards her, not into pornography, not into lust, not into masturbation. There are moral issues, but even beside the moral issues of each of those, some are controversial here or there, but it depletes energy away from the intimacy-building responsibility that you have in your marriage. Is that your physical energy and emotional energy for your wife is to go towards her that creates this whirlwind of energy. She's coming from a little different place, more emotional, most likely, than you're a little more physical. That all works together to create intimacy in your relationship. When you back away, all you have is her emotional energy that works. We don't need just her emotional energy, and we don't just need your physical. We need your physical and her emotional energy creating intimacy in this relationship, creating heat. But you have to lead and be vulnerable. It is really, really challenging. It's one of the most challenging issues in a relationship. But it just know, the romance of a relationship does come back to us. Number 18, he anticipates the stages his children will pass through, and we are to shepherd them through each of these stages. Generally, we have a slide real quick. Let me just show you four stages real quickly. We'll pop this up here, and then we'll pull it back down. We have a funnel, inverted funnel, and a regular funnel. What we would say is that we want to keep things tight at the bottom, 0 to 6. We call that phase establishing authority. 7 to 12, we're rounding the numbers, okay? Doesn't matter. Develop responsibility, facilitate independence at the top end of the funnel. And then we're trying to get to a place where we are friends with our children as they are adults, all right? And so here's what I would say, is when a child is young, we need to establish authority in their life. We're keeping a tight rein on them. They don't need many choices. They don't need the freedom of expression. They got the whole rest of their life to do that. We need to teach them to master themselves, to deal with their sin, to come under authority and learn how to like it. Not just force themselves under authority, but learn how to make peace with that. As they get older, They start to own responsibility and give back and shoulder weight, which deals with their arrogance, keeps them more humble. And then as they get older, they begin to experience more independence and more freedom. But what we are doing is letting them loose young, right? They get to be a teenager. They can't master themselves. They make terrible decisions, and then we try to squeeze them down. And at the very moment where we're supposed to let them go, we're trying to squeeze them down, which feels very inappropriate to them. So there are different stages. You may see all that differently. You may phrase it all differently, understand it differently. Here's what I would tell you. All children are passing through some kind of stages. And where are you? And here's what I can tell you. Even if you can argue with this, what I would tell you is whatever the stage is, you're supposed to be involved in it. You're supposed to be a part of it. You're supposed to be engaged in it. Because I got a 16 and a half year old who is a sharp young lady, and she can handle so many things. And there are days I'm like, you got that? She's like, I do have that. But there are other days I'm like, hey, you don't know what you're doing, do you? She's like, I don't. Can you come help me? I'm like, I'm there. I'll meet with you and your teacher. We'll work this thing out. This is, for her, complicated. For me, not complicated. We'll work this thing out. We'll spin it around and we'll move. We'll keep going. Not just turning it loose, whatever. It's a different kind of connection at the different ages, but we're to shepherd them through that. Number 19. Takes the time to give his children practical instruction about life, which in turn gives them confidence with their peers. When your son knows how to tie a tie, when your children know how to use their money, how to get their oil changed, how to wash clothes, how to make a bed, how to cook, how to shake hands and look someone in the eye, how to ask a woman for a date, how to carry on a dating relationship, how to get a job, how to get married, right? There is this confidence that comes when your child can walk into a situation and they've been equipped to deal with that situation. And they've learned how to bear the yoke while they were young, which humbled them, and now they have some freedom, some confidence. Number 20. He lets his children into the interior of his life. It is part of your job to tell stories. Tell stories about what shaped you, the good and the bad. So when I understand that my dad grew up as a sharecropping family in the poor South, it makes how he views money make sense. It makes an extreme work ethic make sense. I can put it in context. When I learn about some of the success he had in life, it helps me explain some of the confidence that he has. That's really important for your children understanding you. They need to hear the good and the bad. And so you need to let them into the inside. Number 21, he explains sex to each child in a way that gives him a wholesome perspective. Now, it is our job to explain sex to our children. Dennis Rainey has some deals where you get the CDs and you go off with your kids for a weekend and you listen to the CDs and you got a workbook and you fill in the blank and you kind of talk through it all, and it's really great. It's really great, right? I can't fill in blanks too well, so I didn't. My wife did all that. I took my son away and she took the girls away for a weekend and walks them through that initial deal on sex. And I said, here, this is the first of many conversations we're going to have about this issue, but we kind of break the ice in one weekend and we make it into a rite of passage, and it's a big deal. It's a lot of fun. I didn't exactly do it like that, but I mean, we went away, sat on the bed in a hotel in Atlanta Braves game, eat a big meal, Fogo de Chao, had a great time. And we talked about this issue. And kind of a rite of passage, an opportunity to talk. And so my dad said to me, hey, this is kind of a big deal. If you ever have any questions, just ask me. Is that a good thing? It is a good thing. Except that there's no way I'm asking. If I look at my son and say, hey, you ask me whatever questions you got. He's got hundreds of questions. He's never asking those questions. I got to ask those questions. I got to say, here's a question I bet you got. Here's something you need to know. And I got to make myself vulnerable and put myself out there. Interesting story about that. When Vicky was away with one of our girls, I got a call about 10:30 that night. She goes, hey, she's got a question for you. It goes like this. She goes, I was explaining the whole deal to her, and she says, well, does daddy like the sex? She goes, so she wants to know if daddy likes the sex. I was like, daddy do like the sex. Time for mama to come home. All right, 22. Initiates meaningful family traditions. Some of my children are a little more open than others. Initiates meaningful family traditions. What do we do at Christmas? What do we do at birthdays? How do we do the rites of passage? Are there symbols where we have three or four stages where we move a boy from boyhood to manhood? We have three or four stages where we move a girl from girlhood to womanhood, and we recognize that, and we celebrate that, and we cheer that on, and we explain it with symbols, and we talk about it, and we write letters. And to know, you do not need to feel any guilt with extended family. Your extended family cannot override your family traditions. People are like, oh my gosh, we got to go spend Christmas with my family. No, you don't. You have a family now. Now, we want to include all our family. We want to figure all that out. But we are not subject to our family of origin. 23. Initiates fun outings for family on a regular basis. Forever and ever, on my day off, our family, we go to lunch. We homeschooled when our kids were young. We'd always go to lunch on day off. It's a big thing for them. They love going to lunch on Fridays. What do we do on vacation? It's very important. What kind of events do we go to? What do we do that causes us to laugh? I hate camping and picnics. Some of you have built your whole family on that. I think that's great for you. I'm not doing it. Hate it. 24. I had to find other things besides camping and picnics. 24. Takes the lead in establishing with his wife sound biblically supportable family convictions. We have to sit down and talk, and we say, this is how we live. This is how we think. This is how we feel. What do you think about this? Which will determine, here's what we do with our money. Here's what we're going to do with our time. Here's the kind of ministry we're going to be a part of. Here are the kinds of activities that we're going to be a part of. And we're constantly communicating, these are our values. This is what's important. We're constantly trying to win our family over. Here's what, here's why, and we're going to love you until you come on board with this. So for my wife and I, we think about some things the same, but we have some kids. We're trying to get on board. We're constantly saying, here's what, here's why, and love them on board. I stole that idea from Carl George. 25, last one. He connects with other men who are dedicated to developing their hearts and improving their skills as a man, husband, and father. Like at Roundtable. It's a great opportunity. There's other opportunities. You go find mentors. You go find groups. You put together groups, study groups, Bible studies, so that you continue connecting to other men, developing your heart and your skills. All right, so I gave you a list, which can become a religion unless you have trusted in Jesus and being filled by His Spirit. So what do you do now? I would say you pick three things. You get together in your group and you pick three things. It may be two, it may be five, I don't know. But you pray and say, God, what are the three? What are the two, what are the five things that you want to begin working right now? Next year, we'll work on something else. But right now, what are those things? And then you discuss and you pray and you discuss and you pray. And then, like David, when David goes to the front line and everybody's staring at Goliath, and he says, what are you doing? He's an uncircumcised Philistine. He's not part of the covenant. He can't stand. He can't hang. It doesn't matter what you do. He can't win. You can't lose, and he can't win. It wouldn't matter if you went and spit on him, he'd die. He's an uncircumcised Philistine, not a part of the nation. God's not with them. And they're like, oh, you think you're big stuff? He's like, no, I think God's big stuff. And he takes some stones and a bag. And Saul tries to put the armor on him, and he's like, I can't do this. This is not what I do. I killed a lion, and I killed a bear, because God made me great in the moment, and God did what he does, and I'm skillful, and I can't understand it all, but I know that's what God has done. I don't need any of this. And then this cool phrase, and it says, David fled to the battle. It's just an interesting twist about fleeing, because you think you're fleeing away, and it says, David fled to the battle. They're like, hey, David, he's already gone. There's something really powerful about a man who flees to the battle. You don't need a ton of clarity, just a little bit. Just a little bit of clarity. Three things, here's what I'm going to go work on, and boom, flee to the battle. Go get you some and see what happens. Let's pray. Father, we ask that you would help us flee to the battle. I got work to do. I look over this list, and I see things that are missing and broken. I see things I got to work on. And so, Father, would I not do that in the power of my flesh, but would I do that with your Spirit leading and guiding and giving direction to me? And, Father, for all these in the room, that you would lead us, that you would open our eyes to see where we need to go to work and the great work that you want to do, you're not going to tell us. We're going to walk into it blindly. We're going to work really hard, and you're going to lead us. and you're going to do great things because that's who you are. We go and face giants that are not from you, that cannot stand against the work that you want to do in us and through us. We cannot be stopped because this is the work that you're doing. Father, would you lead us now? Would you help us to trust in you and be fearless as we move forward towards all those people that we care about and that you care about? We ask it in your name. Amen.